Hello and welcome to Android Developers Backstage, the exciting podcast. I'm Chet Haas from the Android Developer Relations team.
I'm Romangi from the Android Toolkit team.
I'm Tor Norby from the Android Tools team.
And today we have two guests.
Hi, I'm Sean McQuillan from Android DevRel.
And I'm Yid Boyer from the Android Toolkit.
So wouldn't it have been cool if instead of wasting all that time going one by one, we could have had everybody just sort of do their own thing all at the same time, like possibly in different thread pools, which is an awesome segue into coroutines. Let's talk about coroutines.
That was the worst segue ever.
Okay. Don't worry, we'll fix it in post. So first of all, so coroutines, we're going to talk about coroutines in Kotlin, but why don't we get a little bit of context? Coroutines were not invented in Kotlin. This is just another iteration of a similar concept. I think, Sean, you had been looking into some of the stuff.
Yeah, sure. So coroutines are a really old concept in programming. So they first came from a research paper from 1963 that was published from the COBOL compiler. So it's a kind of the very beginning of programming languages. We discovered this concept.
Whoa. COBOL?
Yes,
COBOL. Something cool came from, is that why they're, oh, it's co-routines, COBOL routines. Yeah. Nice, okay.
That's the one cool thing from COBOL.
All right.
And right. And then later in 67, we saw the first implementation of them in Simula 67.
How many of us?
Well, I didn't until like 3 months ago.
You saw them, right?
Sure.
So then in the last like 15 years or so, they've really blown up. And so now we see them in tons of languages. We see them in JavaScript. We see them in Python. C# has them as well. Go has them. And now Kotlin has them. And I think the thing that's really kind of motivated this trend towards coroutines as a language level construct is kind of the prevalence of internet programming that we all do and how natural they are as a solution to that problem.
When you say we all do web programming.
Sorry, I said this in a room full of people don't make network requests for a living.
What is internet programming?
So what you can do with a program, I don't know if you've tried this, you can actually make a request to the internet and get a response from like a web server.
That's a cat video. That's what he meant. Okay. Yeah. So why is that the use case then?
So it's just really a natural way to express in a programming language. The thing that you would like to do, which is make a network request and then at some time later join and get the result from that network request.
Okay, so it's specifically the latency for the kinds of things that we do for cat video programming.
It's really good for cat videos, yeah.
So in the bad old days, people used threads for this. What does coroutines add to the table?
So coroutines really just changes the way you write your program, like the actual code that you write, and gives you like a mechanism in order to handle this in a nice way in your program. Under the hood, they still use threads. So on Android, when you make a network request with coroutines, there's still going to be some threading going on, but you don't have to spell that out in your program when you use the Kotlin X coroutines library. So it kind of creates a simpler API surface for accomplishing common tasks.
I see. So can multiple coroutines run on the same thread at the same time? No, they can't.
Yeah, they can.
Actually, that's the super cool thing where like you're not really bounded by the limit of threads you can have. So threads are expensive. You cannot have too many of them.
Right. So, okay. So there's not one coroutine per thread. So it is something that's multiplexing.
But it's multiplexing. They're not actually running at the same time on the same thread.
So the compiler is doing the trampoline jump
like
from one to the next?
Them. Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, the same thing your CPU does for your threads.
Right. Okay.
And then it's like you do it in another level, and it becomes the green threads.
I didn't understand that reference. You want to try that one
that's,
again?
That's because normally, like when you're about your threads, your operating system knows, and it's out of overhead of doing it.
Yep.
So you're bounded by a number. Versus in coroutines, it's all compiler magic. It doesn't need to create a full real stack, and it gives you the opportunity to do more, to have more coroutines running in parallel. With less resources.
Right. Okay. I want to roll back a little to the history stuff. So there have been all these different implementations of coroutines in all these different languages and platforms. Like, so then what is the new thing? Or is there not a new thing? Like, everybody does exactly the same thing, but just in different languages.
Well, even in the last 15 years, we've seen quite a bit of evolution in how coroutines are implemented. I think one of the biggest ones we see in Kotlin is we added the suspend keyword, which we decorate functions with, which gives us a whole bunch of interesting promises. So when you make a suspend function, it promises that If it starts some work, like a network request, by the time that suspend function returns, it will have completed that network request, which is a very nice kind of contract to give your caller, which is different than other languages, which when you made the equivalent of a suspend function, it would actually return something like a future, which you could then use inside of the coroutines. So there's a bit of a kind of a transformation that Kotlin did by introducing the suspend keyword and the way that suspend functions work. And that's unique to Kotlin. And it's really quite a nice surface. I think we might see other languages copy it.
Yeah, what's interesting with Kotlin is, like you said, there's a suspend keyword, and where in other languages the keywords or the language level constructs would be async, await, it's kind of high level construct. Kotlin went a different route. So they have the suspend keyword in the language, and then they've built a number of facilities, including a sync await that you find in other languages, as a library on top. So there's a minimal addition to the language. And then they're free. And recently they introduced an improvement, their flow, which I don't know enough to talk about myself. But it was interesting because that's the kind of stuff they can build easily as libraries on top of the language.
And then like from our life, like as Android developers, right? Like you could, the same coroutine code you write, you can actually technically write it in Java, right? Like you make the request and wait until it finishes. But it goes back to the problem, all that time you're unable to use that thread. And like if you have a couple of these, your application is blocked. Versus by allowing you to have multiple coroutines in parallel, like actually Kotlin makes you share that cost. And then I don't think we have async IO right now, but there's like, there's more opportunities in the future to make these things even cheaper for your application.
So how should developers be using coroutines right now? So what should they take the place of for like typical Android programming? Async tasks, you know, whatever executors, so, like what are they doing now that they should think about
that,
changing?
That one we buried long time ago,
yep.
The async task, old friend. So normally, there is like multiple ways you can do this on Android. You could just have an executor pool and like use regular Java executors. Or many people use something like RxJava, which was like by far the most popular library for doing multi-threading. And coroutines fits there very well, where you can actually, with the addition of flow, you can replace all of your executors and all of your RxJava code with coroutines and flow.
Okay,
and it's going to be, once you do that, the advantage is, of course, you got to learn them. But then you suddenly, a lot of callback code, like a nested levels of code in your code base, becomes just like linear programming. It's like the same code that you, if you wrote in Java, that will be super inefficient with a lot of blocking calls, becomes asynchronous, fairly efficient, and easy to read.
Okay. So, sorry, I was going to ask more about the flow thing because you required knowledge of what you were talking about and Romain punted on the knowledge. So can you talk about like what flow is and why that's necessary to replace the RxJava stuff?
Yeah, so one of the really popular use cases for RxJava is kind of this idea of a lazy stream, which is something that when you listen to it, it starts producing values. And it allows you to build some very interesting architectures inside your Android application. And the kind of the key idea there is it produces like one element or a couple elements at a time, and the consumer has to actually use those elements before it can before it produces more. And it also has this other cool thing where it doesn't start producing until someone's actually listening for things to be produced. So Flow kind of fits in that exact same API surface as Flowable from RxJava, which is really, it solves a lot of problems that are otherwise kind of very difficult to solve when you're trying to build more complex architectures.
Yeah, like think about this way. For example, you want to write an application that wants to show users location when you're on the device. So like location is expensive because you need to use more hardware resources to get that. So in your application, when you design this, you need to be very careful not to be listening to the location service unless you are using it right now, like either displaying it to the user or doing something else. Normally, you either like very carefully starting and stopping all this location service, not to leak resources, or you use this flow or RxJava Flowable or even with live data where you can encapsulate logic of listening to the user's location or not in an isolated flow. And in your code base, whenever you access that flow, whenever you start collecting on it, this thing start listening. And if you stop collecting on it, let's say user left the screen, it automatically stops doing that. And this is all built into the stream so that like you avoid doing unnecessary work. Similarly, like you can we do this like if you're using Groom, our persistence library, and if you get a stream of values from the database, so every time data changes, you get a new value. If you use it with Groom, it works in a way that if user leaves the screen, we stop updating it. Or if just like go to the background, if the activity is stopped, it automatically stops updating without the developer manually doing something to stop that work.
Is there a way to use this to solve the permissions API from Marshmallow? You know, when you basically make some function call and then you have to have a callback from your activity to find where you were again to continue computation?
So we don't talk about feature work. there's definitely demand on this. It's not that trivial. Like we are looking into this problem. Hopefully we will have a solution, but it's a lot more complicated than that because like in Android, technically you can ask for a permission. And while we are asking for the permission to the users in the system UI, Android OS may decide to kill your application. And then you need to handle recovering from that is a lot more complicated, but we are trying to find the right balance of how we can provide a better API to make the easy cases easy.
Okay. What about Work Manager? How does coroutines play with Work Manager? Is there overlap there?
No, they are fundamentally different things. So Work Manager is designed to solve deferrable work. Deferrable work is things like, you know, I want my application to be able to synchronize my logs to my backend whenever is a good time, like whenever the device is charging, or things like, you know, I sent an email, it couldn't send right now, but I want to send it eventually when there's network. That's what we call like a deferrable work. So the Work Manager is...
I thought that it was like a replacement for async task where I need to not do this on the UI thread, so run this in the background thread and then synchronize the UI. What is the best Android API for that?
Yeah, so with coroutines, you can do what async task was meant to do. And actually, to go back to Chet's question, one of the interesting things that coroutines solve for app developers is the problem of all the thread pools. So with coroutines, there's this concept of dispatcher. So you can basically choose on what type of thread the coroutine is going to run. It could be UI, it could be like a pool of IO thread, whatever else it is. And so one of the problems we were having in Android apps was, you know, you use library A, it has its own thread pool, library B has another thread pool, the system has its own thread pool in your process, and you end up with like all the threads, so like a lot of wasted memory, you know, wasted computing resources, like maintaining all the threads. And now we have this common language and a more fixed set of dispatchers that people can use. And coroutines come with, you know, a few default ones that you should be encouraged to use.
So does the Kotlin standard library have a thread pool then? Or is there some common Android library that is wrapping it?
How many are there? There's an IO dispatcher.
So there's a three dispatchers on Android. So there's the main dispatcher, which is the main thread. It's just the main looper. And then there's a default dispatcher, which is for CPU-bound tasks, and it's fixed to the size of the number of cores on the device. And then the IO dispatcher, which has basically 64 threads in it.
And so this is in the Kotlin standard library?
No.
It's in Kotlin X coroutines, which is a separate standard library.
Kotlin X coroutines Android or something, right? That's where we get dispatchers.
Do we have a UI dispatcher?
The main one is in the Android.
Complicated. No, like the main one is still in the standard library. It just doesn't have any implementation.
Which I would like to point out is a really confusing developer experience because you can actually call in. You can say, I want to put this in the main pool, and you're going to get an error somewhere in Logcat.
Because you forgot the library.
You forgot to add the library.
Did you file a bug for that?
I did. It seemed like a tooling problem, but it was sort of dependent upon the version of the emulator. It was a little unclear.
I mean,
it would be nice if Studio recognized the message in Logcat and said, oh, would you like to, you know.
Yeah, because it's doing what Sean was telling me about this. Like it's actually using class loading tricks to allow you to call this thing, but then sort of dynamically do stuff at runtime. Right?
Yeah, so it uses a service locator to actually find the actual main implementation.
But the point is, you know, back to your question, Tor, so with async tasks, for instance, you had to like subclass these tasks, you overwrote several methods, different methods would run on different threads. With coroutines, what's kind of nice that you read your code sequentially and you can hop between threads using coroutines, saying, okay, you know, first we're going to do this on, you know, an IO thread, then I'm going to do this on the UI thread. It makes effectively parallel work or, you know, not necessarily parallel, but work that, that has to happen on different threads that are a lot easier to read. And I think that's also the key. Like, coroutines are not about parallelism. You can do parallelism with them, but that's not the main point of coroutines.
That really gets into, I think, like the difference between parallelism and concurrency, which is kind of like a subtle and maybe advanced topic. But the parallelism basically is like when you try to run two things like literally at the same time. So you can think of that as like, I want to make two requests to Room and I want to literally run two actual database requests at the same time. Whereas concurrency is I'd like to kind of switch between a bunch of small things. So we do this already. There's a lot of concurrency on Android in the UI thread where like you handle an on-click listener and then almost immediately thereafter, it actually draws on the screen, hopefully. So that's kind of like an example of concurrency.
I'm not following that one. Usually you handle the click and then you do the thing, right? They're not. These are not things that you've scheduled to happen.
It's more the event loop itself is switching between lots of events on the main thread. So it's like handling an on-click listener, and then later maybe it's handling a layout, and then maybe it's drawing on the screen immediately thereafter. And it just keeps switching between all of these different small tasks.
It's cooperative sharing because everyone knows to write small amounts of code to run in the UI thread. Mm-hmm. It's anti-pattern to do something blocking.
So global scope, we were talking about the different thread pools. Is that like the, you were talking about like the main set of, you know, the then the operating system determines how many threads to have. Is that, so if I asked for, if I asked to launch in global scope, is that like the default threads? Mm-hmm. Like,
so scope is different. Like, so threads, I think like dispatchers are the closest things to your thread pools,
even though they don't
necessarily need to map to thread pools. We do actually have custom dispatchers, but scoping is different. So when you want to do some work, any work, like this is a very common problem in Android. People used to crash where you create an async task, user rotates the phone, and you crash because the async task is still referring to the old activity and it's gone. This was a huge problem. And like we tried to mitigate this problem, but there's solutions in RxJava or live data. But the fundamental problem is that there's no easy way to stop that work. You need to override this method, make sure you canceled everything. Like, that was the fundamental problem, that you cannot get it off work. And scopes kind of help with this. This is my personal understanding, where when you want to launch some work, you say, this is the scope of this work. So if that scope is not valid anymore, that work is not necessary. So imagine you're loading some data for the UI. We provide, as part of Android X lifecycle, we provide you a scope for that fragment. And you use that scope, and then if that fragment is destroyed for whatever reason, you know your work will be canceled automatically. Like, all this cooperative cancellation is built in. You don't, Sean calls this work leak.
Oh, yeah, work leak,
like, yeah. Not a memory work leak. Like, all of this is automated, and you don't need to do anything for this as a developer. Okay.
Unless you've made the mistake of doing a global scope launch for UI-dependent stuff, in which case you've just recreated the async task problem.
Yeah,
exactly.
Right.
You can really kind of, like, if you want to, like, dive into, like, global scope a little more, it kind of maps directly to a global executor service where there's, like, unhandled exceptions go to the thread exception handler, and it just kind of, like, runs forever on a dispatcher, dispatchers.default. I wanted to ask you, like, so for people familiar with RxJava, how would you compare coroutine scopes to, like, autodispose?
Yes, Chet.
Let me be
how
very
do you compare
clear.
Those?
He was not asking me.
Yeah, I'm afraid I don't have the expertise to answer that either. But like, so that's actually how we always try to mitigate. Like, in RxJava, you have this composite subscription. So basically, every stream you create is a subscription, and you like put all of them together into one bag, and then that bag was something you could cancel. So in your like fragments is destroyed, you would cancel that. That will go and cancel all the other things. But you have to do this. Versus in the world of coroutines, just pick your scope, is all built in. Like, some of the fundamental things, is partially why I really like coroutines, some of the fundamental things that you should be doing is already there. You automatically get this. You automatically get things like cancellation, which is super hard in Java.
And really, that's the main problem with you know, threading in general, be it concurrency or parallelism. There are some interesting APIs built in, like the executors and, you know, promises, futures, whatever. But doing this by hand it's a lot of code you have to write. It's tricky. It's easy to get wrong. And so it's nice that now we have all those solutions that are easy to read, easy to maintain, easy to understand, and like take care of the corner cases on your behalf.
Yeah, I remember one thing, it's like 3-4 years ago when we started the first work on like architecture components. We were talking to people, and one interview was I made with one of the instructors in Udacity. I think that was the time the resource we used. Anyways, and they gave me a very long list of problems where like junior developers face. Top of the list was threads. Like people just don't understand threads, especially if you're new to programming or doesn't matter, like after 15 years. And I was like, okay, next problem, because there's no way I can solve this. And like now, finally, I feel like actually we can recommend things to people that can hide most of the details.
Actually, more importantly, what's nice about coroutines is that they solve these generic problems. One of the issues we've had, to take the infamous example of async task, it was designed to do one very specific thing. And a lot of people started also using it. And, it had its own issues, of course. But then a lot of people starting using it as this easy way to do parallelism or threading. But it was never designed to do that. That's why you have executors. So it's fairly simple to come up with solutions that address one specific task. But, what our developers needed was something more generic. And thankfully, Kotlin came up with coroutines.
I would kind of follow up on that with one thing I really like about coroutines is, so while they're a general language construct, they go very deep. You can start building things like flow with them, and you can build really complex architectures using coroutines. They also scale kind of to beginning developers as well. So doing simple things like making a network request is relatively straightforward to do with coroutines if you're just getting started to program. Whereas some of it, I think the other solutions with callbacks and executor services can be a little bit more daunting when you first see them.
Right. So maybe you could start at a simple level. I have to say they're not trivial when you encounter for the first time, at least depends on how they're explained. Mm-hmm. Because there are many different resources on the web. So it depends on what you're trying to do. But even if you go to some of the, I've found the IntelliJ docs, they dive in really deeply, really quickly. Mm-hmm. And if you're new to the concept, it's maybe a little daunting.
I think part of the problem is that we conflate is, again, the fundamental coroutines, like the suspend functions and your dispatcher and your scopes, and then all these things that were built on top, flow. You don't need to understand flow to understand the coroutines themselves. It's just a way to use coroutines. And what's hard is that you get, and it's kind of nice, you get all those tools that come in one package, and you might feel compelled to learn all of it, but you shouldn't. There's different tools for different needs.
It seems like there's an incremental, maybe an advent calendar of coroutines. On the first day, here's what you should do. And on the second day, open up something a little nicer. Right. And then finally, by the time the holiday comes,
what I found too, and we touched on that in one of our Kotlin talks, Chet, is looking at what the compiler actually generates.
Yeah,
helped me better understand coroutines because, so you have this magical suspend function that you invoke, and somehow it can call into something else. It could change thread. It's very, very strange. But when you look at what the compiler actually does, it's not that crazy. It actually wraps your function into a class and it implements a state machine for you. And every time you invoke a suspend function, that's a possible point where your suspend function can effectively return. And at a later point, you can resume after that call. And it's all handled by a very simple state machine. So there's a switch statement on an integer. So you could build this by hand, but it would be error prone. So it's nice to have a compiler doing that for you.
I don't know. I think what I like about coroutines is that you don't need to understand any of it. It just works.
I see. You're that type of programmer. Good to know.
I think one of the things that I found confusing when I started looking at it was, you can only run a coroutine if you're already within a coroutine scope. And I thought, I don't have one. That's what I was trying to do to begin with, right? And so it seemed like this recursive problem. As long as you understand what you're doing, then you understand what you're doing. So just getting to that first step, I thought was a little confusing from the outside. And then you see, you can use these scopes to launch this thing. And now I'm in the world and I can start doing things, little by little. But yeah, that first step tends to be a little tricky.
What does the hello world, or I guess world hello, look like for coroutines?
Well, the one that's on JetBrains website is creating 1 million coroutines that just do a delay.
Yeah.
And they show you that it doesn't take forever.
Yeah, so I think, like, for me, the hello world of coroutines is really just kind of that basic network request, right? So you're going to, like, make a network request. You're going to, like, maybe write the result to a database. And then you can even return things or have side effects like update a live data in that coroutine. The scopes are actually kind of interesting because they got introduced with coroutines 1.0. And then for a while on Android, we didn't have any coroutine scopes that we had in any libraries. So everyone had to kind of write their own coroutine scopes. So like step one to using coroutines was make your own coroutine
scope.
And
I was in the examples of JetBrains, like making your activity be a scope every time, which
exactly.
I do not like.
Can we finish that hello world example you started?
Oh,
so,
sure.
So
he was still working on it in parallel. So just so you know.
Yeah. We were going to join back. Yeah.
So I have a function, uh-huh. right, that I'm calling from my UI thread, and it's making a network call. And this is not great UI, right, because it's blocking the UI. So mm-hmm. I have this function, and now I do what? I put the word suspend on it. So now it's a suspendable function. And in that function, I continue to make a network call. Then what? What do I do for my onclick handler, which triggered this code to sort of make this run in the background or whatever it is?
Yeah. So we've kind of been talking about suspend functions so far. So you kind of, in order to actually switch from a normal function, which is what you're in like an onclick handler, to a coroutine, you have to actually launch a coroutine, which is kind of like, if you haven't played with it before, it kind of maps to making a new thread, but it's really a coroutine instead. So it's lighter weight and multiple coroutines can run on the same thread. So what you'll use is like a view model scope, which is one of the scopes that we've introduced that developers can use in a library. And then you'll say view model scope.launch, and that'll create a new coroutine. And then in there, you can then start calling suspending functions.
Is that a per view model thing, or is it like there's one big scope for all view models?
It's per view model.
All right, so I take my view model and I say, give me a scope.
Yeah, again, think of the scope as the life cycle, right? Mm-hmm. It's not the thread pool or it's not the heavy bits.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, like you get to decide. So like if you are in your fragment, then you can use the fragments scope to do the same.
Right.
It's like
as a developer,
you get to choose like where do I want this operation to continue to live? When I want it to be canceled. Like if you are chat, you can use global scope.
Yes.
I've used
with
global scope.
With the go-to statement. Okay, so I'm back in my onclick handler, mm-hmm. and I had some network call somewhere else. But now I'm just going to take my view model for my fragment, let's say, and I'm going to launch something on it, and I pass a lambda, and that's code that's going to be running in a coroutine.
Yeah, so that'll be running in a coroutine.
And then I just call my suspend function, or could I inline my suspend function code right there inside the lambda?
So for a network request, you'd want to use probably retrofit, which supports suspend functions as one of the things you can actually provide. So you'll just make a retrofit service that exposes a suspend function, and then you can just call that from the coroutine, and that'll take care of all the threading that needs to happen for you, and then just give you the result right away as the result of that function call.
Yeah, but I just want to be still very careful what we say here. So like if you're in your like click listener, you shouldn't really be using your view model scope because you're probably in your fragment. So it's like just use the scope where you are.
So I think Sean had said we introduced a bunch of scopes eventually to make it a little bit easier to do this. So what are the scopes that are available? You said apparently fragment. There's an API in fragment to get
a
scope
for everything that's like logically a scope on Android. So fragments, view, as a scope, because it's something we might destroy to save resources. Fragment itself has a scope.
Wait, fragment view and fragment have different scopes?
Yeah, unfortunately, because of the way fragment works, that was a practical choice. We are not proud, but that's what we could do.
Okay.
It's our motto. We're not proud.
So from the
life give you lemons.
So from the view inside of a fragment, I should use the view fragment scope?
It's usually just use the view scope if you have it. Like if you are in a place where you have the view, like a click listener, you should be just using the view lifecycle scope.
Okay.
There's like more advanced cases where you may prefer the fragment scope, but it's the same way. Like both fragment and the fragments view has life cycles, which is unfortunate. But like a lot of the things we build in architecture components is like trying to fix 10 years of technical debt, so it's not that easy to
improve. Not trying to improve 10 years of
things get wrote. Right. So,
trying to create the next 10 years of technical debt.
Yeah, exactly. Like for the next generations. It's not that hard, honestly. Like when you're writing the code, there's a scope there. Like it's easy to reason about. It's not that like right now we're like talking without an actual sample is so much harder. But when you're writing the code, it's actually easy to find which scope you are looking for.
Mm. And these are APIs on this object? Like Fragment has an API, give me your scope?
Yep, thanks to Kotlin extension functions.
Oh.
It's in the Fragment, nice. Even though it's not.
Okay, so you talked about the Fragment scopes. Would you make a network request in a Fragment scope? Is that the right place to use
it? I hope you
interview
don't,
question.
Please, I mean, please don't. I don't want to there's like a layers. It depends why you are writing the app. Most of the time, no. Like the thing of your like UI. I mean, do you really want to make a network request just because user resize their screen? You want to cancel the request? Like, what kind of a network request is that?
No, but I'm trying to. Like should it be the activity then? So that if the activity is killed, then you don't certainly want the network request being finished to do something, right?
No, but this is different though. Like it depends. So usually we want people to do this kind of stuff in their V model. If you're trying to acquire some data for your UI, that data lives in your V model. So you should be acquiring that data there.
Okay.
So your UI is not responsible to do it. And then you could start that coroutine work in your V model scope. And it will be automatically canceled if user backs out of that activity. But then there's a limitation. Like there are things you may want to do in your UI scope. For example, like one of the samples we have where you want to, like after 10 seconds after user comes to the UI, you want to show a pop-up. So you want to delay 10 seconds. And right now, the easiest way to do this is actually like use the
poster handler.
No, don't listen to Roman. Instead, you just go to the scope, launch a coroutine, say like delay 10 seconds, and then show the pop-up. And that code works perfectly instead of a handler where...
And then we check it on every frame to see if 10 seconds has passed?
We check it every time we dequeue an event from the enqueue.
Yeah, okay. It's very efficient.
I mean, if you want to test the system, you should make 10,000 little 1 millisecond... coroutines sequentially. Back to my hello world example again. So I've made a network call. At the end of the network call, I have some data I want to put into the UI. But I assume that should not be running in the view model scope. Maybe. Like, I don't know how this maps to threads, but generally you're not supposed to do UI from background threads, right? So in an async task, there was a do in background thing and there was like a post result thing, right? So I knew how to partition to work. Basically the presentation was at the end. What is the correct model with coroutines? Do I make multiple coroutines and chain them together? And do I launch them in different scopes?
So you can, inside the same coroutine,
you
can actually like switch execution between threads. And you have quite a bit of control over that. You can kind of, going back to the async task example, you could think about like switching threads as the different callbacks in the async task. If we go back to this hello world, so we've done a view model scope.launch, and then we've made a network request by calling a suspend function. The view model scope.launch actually started on the main thread. So that's going to still be running, and it's going to get that result immediately on the main thread when the suspending operation is done. So it was all main safe, and it was okay to make the network request because retrofit's going to make sure that it actually runs off the main thread, the actual network request itself. But the result is available. You can just assign it to a local variable.
Using retrofit. Let's say that I just made like a socket call and I was blocking. I was doing blocking IO myself.
Oh, you really want to do it. Okay.
Yes.
I like the way you think.
Yeah. So in that case, you can use Kotlin exposes this API called with context. So you can say like with context dispatchers.io, which is that dispatcher that's optimized for specifically for socket calls. And then in that lambda, that lambda is gonna run on the IO dispatcher. So you're free to make as many blocking calls as you want in there. And then the result is available as the result of the with context call.
Okay, and then I turn around and call a different dispatcher for putting...
No, so his assumption was that you were on the main thread to begin with because it was a click handler, right?
Yep.
But there's another situation where maybe you're just in generic code that's not on the main thread, well, and you actually need to farm it out to those two separate threads.
I'm still confused. Like, let's say I start on the UI thread or main thread. I'm then going to run some code on the network thread. I need the result of that thing to be done in order to then turn around back on the UI thread and do something. I'm trying to figure out what is the how do I coordinate these things?
So there was there was this concept. I don't think we really talked about it in this podcast. There's this concept of suspend and resume. And it's kind of like the core thing to a coroutine. If you go back like through all of the languages, this is like kind of universal. And it's basically the idea is a coroutine can suspend itself, which basically means that it's no longer doing any work. It's if it was on the main thread, it's just kind of waiting around to be resumed sometime later. And then later, it can be resumed. So when you actually, when you do this network call with retrofit that we're doing in the Hello World example, the main thread coroutine gets suspended when the retrofit starts actually making the request on another thread. And then later when the result is ready, it's actually going to resume the coroutine back on the main thread. So the result is passed back. There's some synchronization primitives.
That's what I explained earlier with the state machine.
So there's a single coroutine that's doing both of these things, if I understand this. So
two coroutines, actually.
Two coroutines.
You made one magically when you called the retrofit, but you don't have to worry about that.
Yeah. Oh, okay. So I was picturing, so let's take retrofit out of the equation because Tor asked us to.
Okay.
So we have a single coroutine that is going to say with context IO, and then it's going to do some network request.
Uh-huh.
And then immediately following that will be code that we want to run on the main thread.
Yeah.
Right. So since we launched it in the current context, which is the main thread, then when we resume after the IO stuff, then it's going to resume on the main thread and continue work, right?
Perfect.
And the trick to understanding that really is that like with context actually launches a coroutine. You don't have to think about this most of the
launches
time.
Launches and joins, it sounds like.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
So it all makes a new coroutine, waits for the result of that coroutine before it continues.
Okay. So there's an implicit wait at the end of that lambda essentially like, that you're passing into the with
that's
context.
Exactly the BD, like you don't think about that. You when you launch this thing, you said I want to run this thing on the UI thread, and whatever suspend function you called, whatever dispatchers they use, are none of your concern.
I mean, that's what if you've done any threading, it seems like you had the wrong intuition, because you think I'm passing in a lambda to this new thread. And you sort of assume that's a send this request over there, but keep running.
But that's
what
that's
it's really
right.
doing so is it's a blocking.
That's what
call.
Makes coroutine so interesting, because you really read your code sequentially. It's not gonna be running the way you think it's gonna be running, like literally one line after the other without ever pausing, because you know the coroutine will be suspending then resumed. But it makes the code a lot easier to reason about because it's in the order that you wrote it.
Right. But first we have to unlearn what we've been learning the last many years, right, about how threaded programming and asynchronous callbacks
work. This actually, like when I started learning coroutines, that was my first confusion. And because most of the JetBrains documentation also like compares them to threads.
Yeah.
And I confused a lot. And after I started playing with it, I'm like, we should just not even tell people about threads. Just like remove that variable and it will be easier to explain to people.
Yeah,
who
it compares like delay to thread.sleep.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's like a migration thing. Well, here's how you think about this. Here's how to think about
their example of delay is interesting. The reason I think they show you, like, you know, hey, you create a million coroutines that all delay for 1 second. The program does not take a million, you know, seconds to finish. It's because they suspend and they don't block. Yeah.
You've been talking about both dispatchers and scopes. Can you compare and contrast those?
So you can kind of really think about a dispatcher as the thing that ends up actually running the coroutine. And that's quite literally true. So if you go like look through the code for the dispatchers, you'll see that like they have a bunch of functions to like go ahead and do this resume mechanism. You could think of them maybe as like a thread pool if you wanted to like map them to your thread knowledge. Whereas a coroutine scope is very much just a lifecycle. So all it does is have the ability to cancel. And then it also happens to be the place where like uncaught exceptions from a coroutine get sent up to. But you can think of it like in a view model, you'll make a view model scope, and it's probably the right place to start a coroutine in a view model because it's associated with the view model. It'll get canceled when the view model goes away.
I've seen code that says like global scope.launch. I mean, that sounds like a dispatcher to me, not like a scope.
Oh, that was a chat's code?
Yeah.
We deleted that.
Must have been. Yeah.
So global scope has a dispatcher. So all of the scopes have a dispatcher. You can't.
I see. So there's like this blending of, yeah, of roles. Okay.
Yeah, they kind of mix together in a weird way.
Okay.
Has a versus is a.
But if I remember the scopes, scope has a root job, right?
It has an optional root job.
Yeah. Right. And so I assume when you launch from a scope, you parent those child jobs to the root job. And when you exit the scope, like it just cancels the root and that cancels the children jobs. Like, is that how it works?
Yeah, that's the mechanism. Okay. But the way you kind of can think about that without going all the way down to the jobs is every time you launch a coroutine in that scope, if you then cancel the scope, it'll cancel all of those coroutines.
No, but like the mechanism, because you can get access to those jobs yourself if you want. Like you mentioned earlier that retrofit, for instance, is going to join on the result of a coroutine, and you can do that through the jobs, right?
Yeah, you can. All jobs have a join method on them. Yeah.
Well, by the way, like, I mean, also for global scope, like, it's sometimes okay to use it. We're making out fun of it, but yeah.
If you're Chet.
Like, you know, I mean, like, you have some functionality in there, but you don't care. Like, as long as the application is running, you want it to run, like, fine, you can use global scope. That's okay. That's the scope you want. Like, logically, that's what you want, so use it.
Yep. I will do that. Only at the right times. So we mentioned like retrofit has capabilities of like understanding what coroutines are. And I know, so we'll probably get to some of the stuff that the Yeats team has been doing to integrate coroutine functionality. Like what are the libraries that are becoming coroutine friendly that people should know about?
The top two are really retrofit and Room. And SQL Delight is also taking a look at coroutines. And then Work Manager has coroutine support as well, which you need if, even though Work Manager and coroutines solve different problems, once you're in one of these deferred workers, you sometimes want to call a suspend function because you're using that in the rest of your code base. And so you can launch a coroutine worker, which will run a coroutine for you.
Okay. Are there other things that should be in the toolbox? Like once you start playing with coroutines, you probably want to know about XYZ?
I don't know. Like we try to, like whenever it makes sense, like things like our database abstraction supports those. For all the Jetpack libraries, we are trying to cover them.
Okay.
We might be full now. So it's just when you add these dependencies, make sure to get the KTX package. So you get all that functionality out of the box.
One of my favorites is the live data builder that you put together, because it kind of like the live data builder basically gives you a way to create a live data, which is when you want to
produce. Makes sense.
And so it's a way to create a live data that is backed by a coroutine. So whenever someone is actually using that live data to present things on the UI, it's going to actually launch a coroutine. And in that coroutine, you can figure out what the results for this live data are and repeatedly update the live data over time, which is really kind of this nice way to bridge between the world of live data, which is about holding values for the UI, and coroutines, which is all this suspended computation that we've been exploring how to use in this talk.
So this actually, like you mentioned this earlier, like how do I get to the coroutine scope? So there's like... you do face this problem because every other code that's already on Android doesn't know about coroutines. So you need you always need this transition. Like the same thing for like, we created live data because we needed a way to observe data in a lifecycle aware way, like to avoid all the crashes. And so that's therefore that it knows how to talk to the old world. And when we were improving the concurrency support on Android has been one of the top developer demands. And like around 8 months ago, we did a UX research on this. We talked to developers how they solve these problems. And like after all that research, we came up to the conclusion that like the coroutine seems like the right way to go for us. And then we are adding those bindings for you. So when you want to move between the world of coroutines and the world of Android, the tools are there. And like live data is one of them, or like adding coroutine support to other libraries or creating these scopes out of the box is part of that effort. So that when you learn Android development, like in the old world, you learn async task, just don't learn it at all. All you learn is this builder and it magically happens to use coroutines. But like your first introduction to coroutines happens through the way of Android binding. So you don't need to look for anything. That's the first thing you learn anyways.
Can you give me an example where, so Sean just gave me an example for live data. Is there another example like for Room where this is how you should start using this library, using coroutines if you're using Kotlin?
Definitely. So Room is something we did when we're building Room is that, so it's a database access. So you're accessing the file system. And many people throughout the times, they just like make that query on the main thread. I mean, the cursor adapter does that on the main thread. And then randomly, once in a while, your UI locks down, you get an ANR, you have no idea, and then you complain about it. And the fundamental problem is that you're accessing the disk. Most of the time is okay on your developer device. And like out in the wild, it doesn't work because device is busy, the flash disk is slow, whatever. So because of this in Room, we said, if you call Room on the main thread, we're going to throw an exception. We're not going to even let you do that. So Room does this. But versus in the coroutines world, you can actually call Room from the dispatcher's main. If that function is suspend, Room is like, okay, you just call me on the main dispatcher. Room doesn't even look at it. It goes to the background, suspends your coroutine, loads the data and gives back to you on the main thread. Now, like suddenly you can call Room on dispatcher's main and it actually works correctly. So this is why like we wanted, this wasn't easy because we had to deal with the single threaded nature of Android SQLite APIs, which was like very tricky. We're going to hopefully have a blog post about it. But when you want to talk about the threading world and the coroutines world, it's not very trivial.
And again, the key here is what you said earlier, that you can avoid the callbacks, because if you had to call Room on not the main thread, you probably had to somehow know the work was done and then go back to the UI thread to post your results. And here, like, you launch your coroutine on the main thread, you call Room, and when that call returns, you just set data on your UI and you're done. Like, there's no...
So does this obsolete any of the current patterns for using Room?
Not, I wouldn't say absolutely. Like, it's like as you move to using coroutines, I mean, like...
Just easier?
Yeah, it's just... I think, first of all, it's like much easier to start with. This one thing. And like, we are looking into this, especially like Flowis, for example, is a preview. So up until now, even though people used coroutines and RxJava to solve similar problems, RxJava solves a lot more broader problems, like especially these cold streams. But then JetBrains introduced the Flow library, which solves the same problem as well. But is it a preview? Like, we will see how those libraries develop. We are closely watching it. Like, what does it mean for the similar stuff we have? Maybe, I don't know if this will happen, but maybe we'll also tell people, okay, you don't need live data anymore. Just use coroutines and we build this thing for you. Like, we are reevaluating stuff we'll see. And I think we'll just wait and see what happens.
So you had mentioned earlier people that are using what RxJava with Flow, their equivalent of Flow, right? They could use coroutines with the Flow stuff to basically replace that. Is that what most people are using RxJava for? Like, does this end up becoming a replacement, or do they integrate and you keep using RxJava for your current architecture, but then swap in coroutines for some subset of it?
So I kind of want to like take a step back, and because we talked about RxJava a lot here, and one thing that I think some people are sometimes concerned about when we talk about coroutines is like, should they move off of RxJava if they have like a large application that's heavily built using RxJava? And I think the answer is, you know, if you're happy with RxJava and it's working for you, to you know, keep that in your application. It's a great library that solves a lot of problems very, very well. And it's just kind of what we're looking at with coroutines is the ability to produce nice APIs that fit well with Android. So pass it to you for the actual answer. I just wanted to toss that
okay,
one in.
Yeah, I tell you a thing. So it really depends. You don't have to do any of these things. Like for us, it's a little bit different, like from like Android X perspective. Especially when we create architecture components, many people ask us to create an RxJava replacement because it's very complicated, but like we don't want to do that work. It's already a very good library.
It's also probably complicated for a reason. It goes back to what I was saying earlier, where when you try to solve these kind of problems in a generic manner, you end up with something fairly complicated.
Rx is really impressive. Like, yeah. It's a great library.
But it's more like you could build Rx on top of coroutines. It's not... One is not a replacement for the other.
I think Flow pretty much.
Yes, sure. But Flow itself is not coroutines, right? It was built because you have, I mean, it's like, again, like in the coroutine library, you have all those tools that are built on top of the suspend functions and the dispatcher and the scopes and just one implementation. It's a tool on top of coroutines. It's not coroutines themselves.
True. Actually, like one thing we, so from that user experience to show, something we learned was, so actually it's like a very powerful streaming library, but many people don't use it for that. Actually, it's a very nice API to move between threads. People just used it to be able to move between threads. That was literally like, instead of using an executor service, people use RxJava because like you can hop between threads and like modify the stream along the way. And for all of those like one-shot operations, like Kotlin coroutines is a ton more beautiful and easier to write.
And not only that, but even though RxJava is very common in Android applications, using coroutines, I feel, is kind of now a new standard way of doing the same thing. It's kind of nice that, you know, instead of using and learning that library that may or may not be used by others, use something that's closer to the language. So there are higher chances that it will be supported in upcoming tools and libraries. And if you move to a different app, chances are it's going to be using coroutines. So it's nice that we can now all standardize on one thing.
And then, like, one last thing, it's not like RxJava is going anywhere. Like, all the libraries, like, for example, Room, it does work with RxJava, works with coroutines, works with Guava Concurrent. Like, that's what we do, and we'll keep doing that. But, like, one change we are planning to do is, so right now, for example, in Room, we implement everything with using the old threads and executors and, like, create these sugar methods to support coroutines, RxJava, and Guava. With paging, what we're starting to do is write the library itself using coroutines and then create the sugar methods for RxJava and Guava. So we are making the coroutines the first-class solution for our own threading needs instead of using thread pools, but still provide the API. So if you're using RxJava, if you are happy, like absolutely no reason to move. Are you using RxJava, Chet?
I was about to ask Chet.
Every day.
Chet, what is RxJava?
It's spelled Rx. I'll get back to you on the rest. What did we forget to ask about?
Just probably that, you know, it's still fairly early days. I mean, coroutines hit 1.0, when was it? End of last year, right? It was a Kotlin conf.
Kotlin 1.3.
And with some major changes just before 1.0, there was a big major change. And that had been experimental for a while, but you know, this is the early days, I think. And we're starting to see massive adoption like now, and we're going to see. So I'm sure like things will evolve, like Flow is this new thing that.
Is that standard now or is that in beta, the Flow stuff?
It's still experimental.
It's experimental, yeah.
Okay.
So yeah, you know, this is just the beginning of coroutines, and it's going to find its way into more libraries on our side, and I'm sure app developers will figure out new patterns and new paradigms.
All right. Well, thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's suspend.
Thank you.